Part 13 of this ongoing series of Mark Curtis's book, Secret Affairs, British Collusion with Radical Islam. Chapter 20, the last chapter, Good and Bad Revolutions, the Arab Spring. The conservative liberal Democrat coalition government under Prime Minister David Cameron took office in May 2010, at a time when British and its U.S. ally not only faced a global financial crisis, but also numerous political challenges in the Middle East. Although Britain had by now extricated its forces from Iraq, it was still fighting an unwinnable war in Afghanistan and was confronting an Iranian regime challenging several Western policies in the region. Elsewhere, instability threatened to cause chaos in nuclear-armed Pakistan. Israel's brutal blockade of Hamas-controlled Gaza threatened to spark further wars with the Palestinians, while Somalia tottered on the brink of an Islamist takeover. Only the pro-Western regimes in North Africa and the Gulf appeared relatively stable. But even this soon proved illusory as a period of revolutionary upheaval not seen since the 1950s rocked the Middle East in 2011. This witnessed the fall of long-standing dictatorships first in Tunisia in January, then in Egypt in February, and finally in Libya in August, where Muammar Gaddafi's regime was overthrown with the aid of British and French airstrikes lasting 7 months. By the end of 2011, Yemen's leader Abdullah Ali Saleh had been forced to relinquish power to his deputy, and Syria's dictator Bashar Assad was just clinging to power after months of protests bordering on civil war in which the regime killed over 5,000 people. Now, I gotta stop there and say, I'm not sure about those labels there, because Gaddafi has perhaps a mixed record, but I think he was popular among a lot of his people, and you can look it up. Some of the most advanced living conditions in Africa were in Libya before the empire unleashed chaos. And then Assad, if you read or watch interviews, comes across as a highly intelligent man with a sense of what's actually going on. So, you know, it's your call. You look and see for yourself, but I find it questionable when people are labeled dictators, in this case especially. So continuing with this intro to the chapter. At the same time, national elections saw Islamist parties voted into office in Tunisia and Morocco, while in Egypt's parliamentary elections, the Muslim Brotherhood secured more votes than any other party. During the regional turmoil in May 2011, U.S. forces conducted a raid on a safe house in Pakistan, finally killing Osama bin Laden. Again, I will note that Fox News, unbelievably, online, you can find it, Fox News reported the death of Osama bin Laden in, if I remember correctly, 2003. Because if you remember, after the attacks in 2001, there was these stories about him being on dialysis machines and stuff. So anyhow, so just mentioning these things I've mentioned in a previous show. Overall, this book is highly footnoted, highly researched. So, you know, objectively, it's hard to be perfect with a 400-page book covering this amount of stuff. So anywho. Indeed, by this time, the U.S., more often with British backing, was at war with virtually the entire Middle East, executing strikes from unmanned aerial vehicles, drones, in half a dozen countries in the region, but mainly against Taliban militants in Pakistan and Afghanistan. Now, you gotta ask, like, why are they at war in virtually the entire Middle East? Well, that's the gist of the book. During the Arab Spring, British ministers, largely parroted by the mainstream media, have consistently professed that their aims are to spread democracy and human rights throughout the region. Yet, what has rather been in evidence is Britain's exertion of military force to secure its oil and gas interests and its ongoing opposition to democracy, especially in the Gulf states. Both these policies contain elements of ongoing British collusion with radical Islam actors. next section, remaining a major player in the world. The new government's national security strategy released the previous month similarly highlighted the need to, quote, project power well beyond our shores, end quote. Yet the task of maintaining Britain's power in the world is being increasingly challenged by China and India. The world's two emerging superpowers, in the words of Cameron's Foreign Secretary William Hague, together with the broader shift in economic power to the countries of the South and the East, which also include Brazil, Turkey, Mexico, and Indonesia. This shift has been the focus of numerous speeches by British ministers who clearly see it as a major new feature of international relations impacting on Britain's position in the world. Europe Minister David Lidington said in a speech in April 2011 that by 2050 only two European countries will be among the world's top 10 economies. He argued, "We cannot resist this shift, nor should we seek to. Rather, the question is how best we manage it. The challenge for us is to work out how we can best serve our national interests against this changing backdrop. The world is shifting beneath our feet." And further on, the special relationship is also sealed by British firms having invested nearly $500 billion in the U.S. economy. Talking about the military intervention. In the Middle East, the task of preserving British power and influence is harder than ever, and the two key challenges to policymakers, in addition to the threat to British prestige posed by the Taliban's prospective defeat of British forces in Afghanistan, remain Iran and oil. The threat of Iran being a nuclear power able to extend its influence in the region has led to British ministers consistently holding out the prospect of military intervention against Tehran, largely in support of the U.S. and Israel. William Hague told Parliament in September 2010, the option of military action should not be withdrawn from the table. Where did that phrase come from? The table. They always like refer to the table. And the following month, he said in a media interview, I'm certainly not calling for a military action, but none of us in among the NATO countries would have ever taken off the table the prospect of a possibility of military action. Indeed, in November 2011, media reports suggested that the British military was stepping up contingency planning for potential action against Iran amidst ongoing concerns about Tehran's nuclear enrichment program. Military planners were reportedly examining where best to deploy Royal Navy ships and submarines equipped with Tomahawk cruise missiles as part of what would be an air and sea campaign. Well, that's just what Trump and company, was it 56 or 59 Tomahawks on Syria? The U.S. under the Obama administration, meanwhile, has continued to issue directives authorizing covert action in Iran, notably to fund Iranian dissident groups through the U.S. Agency for International Development, while Secretary of State Hillary Clinton has said that the U.S. is doing a lot to support the opposition in Iran. Continuing to ensure Western access to and control over Middle Eastern energy resources is now more complex than in the earliest post-war period and bound up with the emergence of the new global powers. Largely unnoticed by the mainstream media, British ministers in the coalition government have given speech after speech reiterating that, quote, access to existing and untapped energy resources is becoming more difficult, end quote, and that Britain is increasingly dependent on imported oil and gas. As production from the North Sea declines, imports of gas are expected to rise from 30 to 50% of Britain's energy needs by 2020, for example. In a speech of February 2011, Foreign Minister Lord David Howell said that we want to secure energy prices that are both predictable and affordable, but noted that they have recently been anything but, with oil prices reaching a record $147 per barrel in summer 2008 and then crashing to less than 46 months later. Energy security, again, a key takeaway from this book. And here I have a note about hardly anybody talks about overpopulation when they project these stats, how to control that. That's a whole show. As world energy consumption is predicted to double in the next 25 years, the fundamental challenge is that global competition for resources is rising and leading to higher oil prices in an era when Western economies are already undergoing a financial crisis. The British analysis is that its problems concerning oil and gas are principally caused by the pressures being exerted on world energy markets by the rapid growth of China and emerging economies who are hungry for abundant and affordable energy. Howell notes that China recently overtook the U.S. as the world's largest energy consumer, and that 93% of the increase in energy demand between now and 2030 will come from non-OECD countries. What ministers have been saying, with only a slight reading between the lines of these numerous speeches, is a repetition of the constant post-war mantra that who controls oil supplies will control the future of the world economy. In February 2011, Lord Howell told a conference in Japan on the subject of the future energy challenge that this new energy landscape requires a different, more agile diplomacy than in the past to guarantee both our energy security and our wider safety. And further on, Britain had been a significant arms supplier to the Mubarak regime in 2010. Deliveries had included components for all-wheel drive vehicles with ballistic protection, military communications equipment, surveillance equipment, and components for armored personnel carriers and submachine guns. I skipped ahead a page, so here, backtrack a bit. That quote from Lord Howell also included... I have on the side note, ha, with exclamation point. So here he's saying, the present Middle East political turmoil presents an acutely vivid picture of the dangers to conventional energy patterns. You can, you know, read between the jargon, the pictures of the present Middle East political turmoil presents an acutely vivid picture of the dangers to conventional energy patterns. Like Europe, Japan draws substantial oil supplies from that region. We must do all we can to ensure that legitimate aspirations for democracy and freedom are balanced with orderly political evolution in the countries and societies of the Middle East region, and to allow the peoples of the Arab world to work out their future in a context of stability. That's the kind of stuff when I first heard Obama talk that is just like verbiage that really doesn't say anything, you know, to work out their future in a context of stability. And conventional energy patterns means, you know, what they're used to. It's like the addict is used to going to the corner to get his heroin, and then, you know, the something changed, so he no longer has a conventional energy pattern. Key point amongst all this flippant talk here is this: how the energy underlies, you know, all these decisions. And then further on is a mention of 66% of all oil production from Saudi Arabia goes eastwards. A large proportion of China's fossil fuel imports come from this region. This cannot be brushed aside. It is a decisive element in the unfolding pattern of Middle East reform. As far as we are concerned, there are some energy implications to which we should not be blind. Egypt itself is not a major energy producer, but it has some oil and quite a lot of gas, which it exports through the Arab peace pipeline to Jordan, Syria, and Israel. Extraordinarily, perhaps this is often overlooked, Israel relies on Egypt for between 30% and 40% of its daily gas supplies. The continuation of that pipeline is an extremely important element in the situation. All over the region, new gas pipelines are being developed, such as the so-called Islamic gas pipeline between Iran, Iraq, and Syria. We have to understand that a new pattern of energy transportation and production is emerging in the area. And that was William Hague. And that little section ends up with the need to counter Chinese influence and ensure continued control over Middle Eastern energy resources has been paramount during the Arab Spring. We look today at unfolding events in Egypt, Gaza, Israel, Jordan, Syria, and Iraq, and they will all have an effect on energy security, Lord Howell said in February 2011. In Parliament, a week later, he outlined British interests in the Middle East as including countering radicalization, securing energy supplies, and ensuring open and accessible markets. It also includes working to promote an environment in which trade and investment can flourish, though through shared standards and a level playing field for business. Yeah, a level playing field, depending on, you know, who's making up the rules, and encouraging participation by all members of society. Let's see, Europe Minister David Lidington later put it more bluntly, telling an Atlantic Council meeting in the U.S. that the Western interest in the Arab Spring should be, quote, the spread of capitalist democracy. Oh, there's the oxymoron of the month, or of the 5 centuries. Capitalist democracy. Indeed, British policy towards each of the recent upheavals in the Middle East has been shaped by its energy interests in the context of this increasing rivalry with China and declining British influence. Once again, the promotion of basic British policy has witnessed a role for Islamist actors. The next section, taking out insurance, re-engaging the Muslim Brotherhood. The popular revolution that overthrew Mubarak in Egypt on February 11, 2011, occurred after 18 days of demonstrations spearheaded by young secular protesters that united most sections of Egyptian society fed up with 3 decades of repressive, corrupt rule. Britain had, along with the U.S., consistently supported Mubarak since he took over from Anwar Sadat in 1981 and continued to back him right up until his demise. Just 3 months before Mubarak fell in 2010, William Hague made his first visit to Cairo as foreign secretary, proclaiming that Egypt is a key regional and international partner. 5 months later, a new British ambassador to Egypt, James Watts, said that Egypt's role is critical for the future stability and success of most of the region, and that Britain had strong shared interests with Egypt, and I intend us to continue being an engaged and active partner, drawing on all the resources we have to offer. Indeed, Britain had been a significant arms supplier to the Mubarak regime. In 2010, deliveries had included components for all-wheel drive vehicles with ballistic protection, military communications equipment, surveillance equipment, and components for armored personnel, carriers, and submachine guns. And there were reports of, maybe it was George Soros or the whole Arab Spring being a funded thing so that there could be a crackdown. And a bunch of times he refers to some meeting with a Muslim Brotherhood guy that was not reported in the mainstream British media and not mentioned on the Foreign Office website. And farther on, this has to do with, clearly such concerns about bolstering the Brotherhood did not prevent subsequent British contacts, albeit at lower than prime ministerial level. Indeed, in June 2011, the British ambassador to Egypt, James Watt, told journalists at the British Embassy in Cairo that there was no threat to stability in Egypt from the Muslim Brotherhood, and according to an Arabic news report, that Britain was applying no conditions on Britain's support during this transitional period. At the same time, Watt reportedly noted that BP had decided to invest a massive $11 billion in Egypt. British policy is not to overly support the Muslim Brotherhood or to want to see Islamist policies predominate in the future Egyptian government. Ministers have openly opposed the prospect of this and have welcomed the secular nature of the opposition to Mubarak, and there is no evidence to doubt that this is the British position. In a media interview in February 2011, William Hague said that there was a danger of a Muslim Brotherhood in takeover in Egypt, and that if an election were held, other opposition parties might not be strong enough to win. Rather, meeting the Brotherhood is clearly a way of ensuring Britain protecting its strategic and commercial interests in the likely event that the organization plays a key, even dominant role in the political transition of or future government. British re-engagement with the Brotherhood has been mirrored by U.S. policy. The media has reported that the Obama administration has reassessed its relationship with the Brotherhood, resumed formal contacts with it, and that is ready to cooperate with it so long as the Brotherhood respects the rule of democracy, minorities' rights, and human rights. The latter concerns are mainly for public relations purposes, since the priority in Washington and London is to ensure a pro-Western political transition in Europe, in Egypt, that protects Western financial investments. And towards the end of that section, British officials can be expected to deepen their arch-pragmatic stance towards the Muslim Brotherhood, especially in the light of the latter's election gains. And next section, Libya, Islamist boots on the ground. Gaddafi was killed in October 2011. The Islamist forces were only part of the military opposition that overthrew Gaddafi, but were an important element, especially in the east of the country, which was where the uprising began and which had provided the center of opposition to Gaddafi. The episode, to some extent, echoes past British interventions where Islamist actors have acted as among the foot soldiers in Britain's policy to secure energy interests, that the British military intervention to overthrow Gaddafi was primarily motivated by such interests seems clear in the absence of access to government files, to which we briefly turn later. Such oil and gas interest in Libya, however, has been downplayed by ministers and largely ignored by the media in favor of notions of Britain being motivated by the need to support the human rights of the Libyan people and promote democracy. Concerns completely absent when it came to defending the rights of other Middle Easterners being abused at precisely the same time, notably Bahrainis, to which we turn in the next section. Military operations were coordinated with France, while the U.S., which played no overt part in the military intervention, authorized $25 million in covert aid to the rebels in April. The NTC, let's see who that is, National Transitional Council, that's in Libya. The NTC's military forces were led by various former Libyan army officers, such as Colonel Khalifa Haftar, who had set up the Libyan National Army in 1988 with support from the CIA and Saudis, who had been living for the past 20 years near Langley, Virginia, home of the CIA, which also provided him with a training camp. But Islamist elements were also prominent. Two former Mujahideen who had fought in Afghanistan led the military campaign against Gaddafi forces in Darna to the east of Benghazi, for example. Abdel Hakim al-Assadi, an influential Islamic preacher who spent 5 years at a jihadist training camp in eastern Afghanistan, oversaw the recruitment, training, and deployment in the conflict of around 300 rebel fighters from Darna. Both al-Assadi and his field commander on the front lines, Salah al-Barani, were former members of the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, the Islamist force that had long targeted Gaddafi and which Britain covertly funded to kill Gaddafi in 1996. He mentions WikiLeaks cables. Former CIA operations officer Brian Fairchild wrote that since the epicenter of the revolt in Libya is rife with anti-American and pro-jihad sentiment, and with al-Qaeda's explicit support for the revolt, it is appropriate to ask our policymakers how American military intervention in support of this result in any way serves vital U.S. strategic influences. And then a note that what is known is that the state of Qatar was a major financial backer of the Libyan rebels. And further on, once again, the episode highlights how expedient British policy towards the LIFG was, covertly supporting the organization in the mid-1990s and acquiescing in its presence in London as a counter to the Libyan regime, then taking action against it at the behest of Gaddafi, while later finding itself on the same side again and working alongside those such as Qatar, providing significant military and financial support to it. So it's the friend-enemy revolving door. Friend-enemy-friend. It was only when domestic forces rose up in opposition to Gaddafi in early 2011 that Britain again switched allegiance back to anti-regime forces. The British concerns all along have been mainly commercial, linked to energy interests. It was oil interests that inspired the Blair government to start dealing with Gaddafi after 2003. Anglo-Dutch oil company Shell signed a deal with Libya's state-owned energy group in March 2004, covering the establishment of a long-term strategic partnership, and British ministers and senior civil servants met Shell to discuss the company's oil interests in Libya on at least 11 occasions and perhaps as many as 26 times in the subsequent 4 years. BP, meanwhile, announced an agreement to explore for oil and gas, potentially worth up to £15 billion in May 2007. Britain was so beholden to the trade opportunities offered by Gaddafi that Blair's successor Gordon Brown refused to put pressure on the Libyan regime to pay compensation for 200 victims of the IRA's lorry bomb that exploded in London's Docklands in February 1996, the Semtex explosive for which is suspected of having been supplied by Libya. Letters sent by Brown and Foreign Office ministers to those seeking compensation made it clear that the government was unwilling to put any pressure on the Libyans that might jeopardize British trading and commercial interests. So that, you know, that speaks to the news and what news stories, you know, you could have several outrageous news stories, but one of them might get highlighted because another one starts to get too deep into, you know, who's trying to protect what. And here's I have a note, bombing stuff they sold. One British company was allowed by the government to supply riot control training to the Libyan police, while Whitehall also secured an £85 million deal for a communications system for Libyan tanks. These tanks were subsequently bombed by NATO in 2011. However, in the months preceding the 2011 uprising, there were also signs that the Gaddafi regime's conciliatory stance towards the West was again changing. Particular, in late 2010, the state-owned Libyan National Oil Company announced that it was not expecting to issue any new oil concession licenses in 2011. This was a sign of the growing resource nationalism in Libya, identified in a November 2007 memo by the U.S. Embassy in Tripoli, later revealed by WikiLeaks. The memo argued that the Libyan regime was in the process of reworking long-standing oil concessions with several different IOCs, international oil companies, and was promoting a resurgence of measures designed to increase the GOL's, government of Libya, control over and share of revenue from hydrocarbon resources. It added that those who dominate Libya's political and economic leadership are pursuing increasingly nationalistic policies in the energy sector that could jeopardize efficient exploitation of Libya's extensive oil and gas reserves. These concerns reinforced the notion that Britain and its allies viewed the opportunity to remove the regime that presented itself in early 2011 as too good to be missed, and Islamist forces helped them to do this. Well, without knowing the whole history, it sure seems similar to Venezuela, where Chavez was nationalized the oil revenues and started to improve conditions in Venezuela. And Chavez's death, there is some suspicion as to that. Some kind of induced cancer is a possibility, as research has shown. The amount of times that Castro, the various techniques that were attempted with Castro, which didn't work, and then to see that Gaddafi was overthrown and killed, so it's, I don't know, but it's interesting parallels. And I think we can get the last bunch of pages here, this section, this show, two more sections in the book here, the Saudi Arabia and the Utility of Intervention. It's a little bit longer than some of the other shows, but hey, I'm wrapping it up here. Except for, I'm going to do one more show, a summary, because it's such a long book and so much information that it'll help me to sum it up, and hopefully the summing up will help you too. All right. Whitehall's long-standing special relationship with the theocratic rulers in Riyadh has been enhanced by the new coalition government at a time when evidence continues to emerge on the extent of Saudi funding of terrorism, and when the Saudis have taken drastic measures to clamp down on democracy in Arabia. Britain's alliance with the House of Saud has also taken on new importance with the coalition government's announcements of deepened relations with the Gulf states. The new government's Gulf Initiative, aiming to enhance trade and investments with countries such as Qatar, Kuwait, the United Arab Emirates, and Oman, has resulted in a string of meetings with the region's autocratic rulers and constant apologias for their rejection of democracy, but have been ignored by the mainstream media. Now, just in the news was Saudi Arabia taking over a bunch of oil refineries or oil control in Texas, I think it was, and that particular refinery having a whole bunch of outlets in the south. And Curtis continues, as noted in Chapter 18, Saudi Arabia has long been the most significant source of funds for radical Islamic and terrorist causes around the world. A secret cable written by U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton in December 2009, revealed in late 2010 by WikiLeaks, noted that, quote, donors in Saudi Arabia constitute the most significant source of funding to Sunni terrorist groups worldwide, and that Saudi Arabia remains a critical financial support base for Al-Qaeda, the Taliban, LET, Lashkar-e-Taiba, and other terrorist groups, including Hamas, which probably raise millions of dollars annually from Saudi sources. The cable added that it has been an ongoing challenge to persuade Saudi officials to treat terrorist financing emanating from Saudi Arabia as a strategic priority, and that Riyadh has taken only limited action to interrupt the flow of money to terrorist groups which have launched attacks in Afghanistan, Pakistan, and India. Yet not only Saudi Arabia, but also other Gulf states were recognized in the cable as being the source of terrorist funding. Phew, that's some stuff. And to a bunch of stuff, he says, finally, Qatar has adopted a largely passive approach to cooperating with the U.S. against terrorist financing, and its overall level of counterterrorism cooperation with the U.S. is considered the worst in the region. Terrorist groups were said to exploit Qatar as a fundraising locale, and although Qatar's security services have the capability to deal with direct threats and occasionally have put that capability to use, they have been hesitant to act against known terrorists out of concern for appearing to be aligned with the U.S. and provoking reprisals. That's a loaded sentence there. They have the capability to deal with direct threats and occasionally have put the capability to use, but they have been hesitant to act against known terrorists out of concern for appearing to be aligned with the U.S. and provoking reprisals. Wow. It's a lot of it's about, you know, whose stick is hitting who and whose money's going where and who's aligned to who but the law of the land is beyond them, it seems. It is also noted that Qatar has a diverse range of investments in Britain and is a major supplier of energy, providing 11% of Britain's gas demand. The Gulf states, including Saudi Arabia, now account for around half of all British arms sales. Here's David Cameron in a speech to the Kuwait National Assembly in 2011. It is not for me or for governments outside the region to pontificate about how each country meets the aspirations of its people. It is not for us to tell you how to do it or precisely what shape your future should take. There is no single formula for success, and there are many ways to ensure greater popular participation in government. We respect your right to take your own decisions while offering our goodwill and support. And then Curtis adds, these words can be expected to be received gratefully by Gulf leaders keen to stave off the threat of democracy. The threat of democracy. And further on, the Sultan Qaboos, Qaboos of Oman, meanwhile, has been in power since a British coup installed him in 1970 and became the world's longest-serving ruler once Gaddafi was overthrown, a fact not advertised by Whitehall. Qaboos's regime, a major British ally, was described as enlightened and effective. In reality, Oman is an absolute monarchy with almost all power concentrated in the hands of the Sultan, who serves as chief of state and head of government, supreme commander of the armed forces, prime minister and minister of defense, foreign affairs, and finance, in addition to personally appointing all other ministers. Now's the time for the word dictator. Here we have Minister Lord Howell, who told an audience in Riyadh that Saudi Arabia is the heart of world oil production that underpins global markets, located in a region which contains the planet's largest oil reserves. Thus, in the words of the Foreign Office website, Saudi Arabia and the United Kingdom have long been close allies, and the breadth and depth of Britain's relationship with the kingdom continues to increase. The website adds that the two countries have a shared interest in ensuring regional stability. Stability here is understood as ongoing British-Saudi opposition to democracy in the region and the long-standing British backing documented in previous chapters of Saudi Arabia's role of superpower on the Arabian Peninsula to ward off threats to continued feudal rule. One case in point is the Saudi intervention in Yemen in 2009 when its air force bombarded the northwest Yemeni region of Sada'a to counter the Shia Houthi insurgent group. The action was undertaken in support of Yemeni government forces, which had earlier launched a military offensive against the Houthis called Scorched Earth. And that's been documented other parts of the world, the Scorched Earth policy. The Saudis used British-supplied Tornado fighter bombers, damaging or destroying civilian buildings such as marketplaces, mosques, petrol stations, small businesses, a primary school, a power plant, a health center, and dozens of houses and residential buildings. Amnesty International commented that the Saudis carried out indiscriminate attacks and other violations of international humanitarian law that resulted in hundreds and possibly thousands of civilian deaths. But the Saudi role as regional policeman in counter to democracy is principally evidenced in its intervention in Bahrain in March 2011. That goes on and on. That's as much as I can handle right now. See, later on, he says, evidence has also emerged from... It's just, yeah, some of that stuff is just, it's just horrid. The violence and stuff perpetrated while they say, you know, while they say other stuff and ensuring regional stability. I mean, it's sadly laughable. Saudi forces entered Bahrain in a convoy of British-made... Oh, wait, here we go. Evidence has also emerged from two diplomatic sources at the UN that the Saudis were given a green light to intervene in Bahrain by U.S. Secretary of State Clinton Hillary in exchange for a yes vote by the Arab League for the no-fly zone over Libya. And here I have a note that this is similar to Standing Rock. Saudi forces entered Bahrain in a convoy of British-made armored personnel carriers known as Tacticas, which were manufactured by the British company BAE Systems. Saudi Arabia's National Guard, trained by Britain since 1964 to ensure the defense of the House of Saud, was part of the Saudi force, and British training in internal security over many years would no doubt have helped develop tactics to suppress the popular uprising in Bahrain. And there's mention of tear gas, crowd control, ammunition, equipment use of aircraft cannons, assault rifles, shotguns, sniper rifles, and submachine guns. So all very much of that stuff, perhaps not as nastily, but to some degree, those were unleashed along with dogs, attack dogs, on people, often in prayer at Standing Rock. And a little further on, in the early hours of 17 February 2011, the Bahraini police moved into the Pearl Roundabout area of Manama to clear the encampment of protesters, and in a brutal crackdown left 5 dead and over 200 injured. Foreign Secretary Haig said that he conveyed the concern of the British government to Bahrain and urged all sides to avoid violence and the police to exercise restraint, while praising the regime for recent important political reforms and the long friendship between Bahrain and the UK. And that little section ends up talking about human rights and training with Bahrain. And then while Cameron was hosting Al Khalifa, hundreds of people wrongfully detained or convicted following unfair trials were still languishing in Bahraini jails, while those dismissed from the posts had received no signs of being reinstated. So, the hypocrisy, hypocrisy. And just going to wrap up this with the last page and a quarter called The Reckoning. And if there's other little notes to catch up on, those can be done in the summary. So here it is, The Reckoning. Current British policy in the Middle East is as expedient as it has been over the last century. The reliance on making deals with the Taliban and on their supporters in Islamabad, together with pragmatic engagement with the Muslim Brotherhood, are policies that previous generations of British planners would recognize with the alliance, while the alliance with the arch-fundamentalists in Saudi Arabia has been a major constant. The primary threats to British interests in the Middle East have changed over the decades, from Russian expansion to Arab nationalism to, presently, a resurgent Iran, with an omniscient fear being that of independent development. But the fundamental predicament has been declining influence in a region where Britain retains critical interests, ensuring overall Western control of oil and the resources flowing from oil to the greatest extent possible by maintaining favored regimes in power. Having declined from the supreme architect of the region that imposed its country borders and rulers to a second-rank power that clings to Washington's coattails, Britain is now in a weaker position in the region than ever, overwhelmingly reliant on the U.S. British elites have had few qualms or illusions about those with whom they have collaborated to achieve their goals, and their policy has been based on short-term calculations of maximizing influence. The fact that collaboration with Islamists or terrorists has been pursued with little heed paid to the longer-term consequences is a sign of the weak position in which the British have constantly found themselves. British influence in the Middle East in recent decades should not be exaggerated, but there is no doubt that it has contributed to the rise of radical Islam and the undermining of secular, more liberal forces, which the British public is told by their governments and media are Britain's allies around the world. The policy has promoted violence and wars, the overthrow of often popular governments, the bolstering of the most reactionary domestic forces, as well as tensions between states and sectarian divisions within them. Government policies are widely believed to be pursued in the, quote, national interest, end quote, but this is a myth. Britain's foreign policy-making system is far removed from promoting the public interest. Rather, Whitehall's secret affairs with radical Islam have increased the terrorist threat to Britain and the world. A distinctly immoral aspect of foreign policy has made Britain, the Middle East, and much of the rest of the world more insecure. So there's Curtis's wrap-up assessment, and that'll do it for this show. There'll be one more with a kind of overview summary. So thanks again for hanging in there in this long series. Significant in the context of world affairs, where history helping to understand what's going on now and perhaps what's going to go on in the future, or perhaps how to make some positive changes. So thanks for listening. Have a good one.